and my God has become my strength. He says, it is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you as a light for the nations that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. And the New Testament reading is Mark 7:14 through 8:10. So get ready for a long reading. But it was I was really enjoyed reading this earlier this week. Okay. And he called the people to him again and said to them, hear me, all of you, and understand, there is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him. And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from the outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart but his stomach and is expelled? Thus he declared all foods clean. And he said, what comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person. And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. But she answered him, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And he said to her, for this statement you may go your way, the demon has left your daughter. And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment. And they begged him to lay his hands on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears and after spitting touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all these things. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. In those days, when again a great crowd had gathered, and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way. And some of them have come from far away. And his disciples answered him, how can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place? He asked them, how many loaves do you have? They said, seven. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground. And he took the seven loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And they set them before the crowd. And they had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said that these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied. And they took up the broken pieces left over, seven baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people. And he sent them away, and immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. This is the reading of the word. Go ahead and come on up, and I'll pray for you, Milas. Father, I thank you that we get to read your word, but then also hear it proclaimed to us. And so I pray that that you would speak through Milas, and that our hearts would be open to hear what you have for us. And we pray these things in your name. Amen.
Thanks, Sherry. All right. Let me get settled here. I'm all thrown off because my table's being used. So we'll see if we can still do this. Had to get my timer. This is for your good. We got a lot to talk about today, but Mark preached a little bit shorter last week, so he said I could use the extra time that he didn't use this week, so there we go. Have you guys all read Franz Kafka's The Trial? Raise of hands. Okay, Lindsay, good, thank you. Well, I haven't, but Tim Keller has. It's going to be a Tim Keller heavy morning. I do want to give a plug. I've been reading this as kind of a resource for sermon prep. It's called Jesus the King. It's basically Tim Keller's sermon series on Mark put into a book, and it's pretty easy read, and it's been really helpful for me. I'll be kind of referencing that some this morning, but in this book, he references this book by Franz Kafka, The Trial, which from what I can understand is basically this this man is arrested, and he doesn't know why, and nobody tells him why, and he spends his whole life in prison, and he doesn't know why. But he keeps thinking to himself while he's in prison, well, maybe it was this thing that I did, or maybe it was that thing that I did. He keeps thinking, maybe I am guilty. He has this sense that maybe he is where he belongs when he's imprisoned. And Tim Keller makes the point that deep down, all of us have this sense, this sense that we are guilty, the sense that we're maybe even unclean. I think the reality is that we do have what I'm calling this morning a purity problem. There is something about us that is impure. We are unclean. And there's two kind of common responses to this reality. One that I think would make Franz Kafka's novel a little bit less of a bestseller these days is we try to just deny this. We try to deny that we have any purity problem. No, anything that comes from within me is actually pure, and anything that I think is not pure is just a social construct. It's what the culture is telling me. And so we try to convince ourselves that no, there really is no purity problem. Or maybe we do accept that there is a purity problem. We try to solve that by purifying ourselves, by making ourselves pure. This is what we call maybe purity culture. I even kind of hesitated to use the word purity this morning because of all of the negative connotations that we have with that word in our society, but I think it really does speak to the issue that Jesus is talking about this morning. That we do have a purity problem, but Jesus would say it's not right to just deny that we have a purity problem, but he also would say that our response to it of trying to purify ourselves is also not adequate. So how do we solve our purity problem? That's what Jesus is going to talk about this morning. We see it beginning in our reading this morning. I think I have some verses up here. If you want to follow along, you can. I'm just going to be taking little kind of excerpts from bigger sections. Let me grab my water real quick. But the first thing that Jesus tells us is that we do have a purity problem. So merely just ignoring this reality, we feel impure, or trying to accept ourselves for who we are is not actually going to solve anything. Jesus says that pretending that the purity problem isn't there is not going to work because we do actually have a purity problem. So we kind of skipped a section. I don't know if you were following closely. You might have noticed that last week we left off, I think, at the end of chapter 6. And I skipped a few verses. That's because I preached on the parallel passage to those verses in Matthew a couple of months ago. But Jesus had this interaction in this section that we skipped with the Jewish people about why him and his disciples didn't follow kind of their purity laws. And one of the reasons that maybe we would guess that Jesus didn't follow the purity laws is because he didn't think that there was such a thing as a purity problem. But that's not the case. What Jesus says here is actually not that we don't have a purity problem, but that the purity problem is actually way worse than we think it is. He says you're impure not because of what you eat or the things that go inside of you from the outside, but you're impure because of what's inside of you. Your purity problem is not the things outside of you, but the things that are inside of you. I've said this before, but one way to think about this is to think about the reality that you're not a sinner. I'm not a sinner because I sin, but I sin because I'm a sinner. Does that make sense? The things that we do with our hands are a result of what's going on in our heart. The purity problem that's on the outside actually begins on the inside. We are sinners because we sin because we are sinners. We are not sinners because we sin. We have a purity problem. Now this goes against kind of everything. Look at that, Isaac. You are a gem. You're not allowed to go anywhere. Don't move to Jersey. Just kidding.
And this goes against everything that our world is telling us right now. Everything our world is telling us is that we're supposed to accept ourselves for who we are and find our true identity way deep down on the inside. That's the real purity, and everything that's caked on from the outside is impure. But Jesus would say, no. The deeper you look, the deeper you find impurity. And this isn't just a problem that's outside of the church, but we have it inside the church as well, right? Like, well, my sin's really not that bad. Really, deep down, I'm a good person. How could God ask me to live in a way that's contrary to how I naturally feel? It's not that big of a deal. My sin's not that big of a deal. But the Bible would tell us, and I think Jesus would tell us this morning, that this is a deadly way to live. And I think that we know that this is true too, right? Like, why is it so hard to accept who we are and just live from the inside out? I think it's because deep down we know that there's something not right. Not right within us, not right about trying to find our true self. We have a purity problem. So what do we do about it? Got the purity solution here in the next slide, thanks. I think that one of the reasons that we react negatively against this idea that we have a purity problem is because of the way we've seen that dealt with in our society. Ashley and I are watching Amazon special on the Duggar family. I don't know if you're familiar with this family and a cult that they were a part of. And this is kind of the poster family for what we would call purity culture, right? They did recognize with Jesus there is a purity problem. And so they tried to do something about it by having women dress a certain way and frankly beating their children into submission at a very young age to try to purify themselves from the impurity. I just want to say it's right for us, I think, to be disgusted at some of this, to recognize the abuse and the shame and the oppression that comes from this kind of purity culture. And I think that Jesus would also warn us against this approach to purifying ourselves. First of all, because it doesn't actually work. Trying to purify yourself from the outside in does not actually work. Jesus knows that this is not an adequate solution to our purity problem, and so he also condemns purity culture. Essentially, this is what the Jewish people had. They had this culture of purity, of purifying themselves from the outside in, and Jesus says, no, that's not ultimately going to work. And this was confusing for the Jewish people because God had given them these purity laws. Back in Leviticus 11, we have very specific laws about what people could and could not eat, and so you might wonder, well, why if you're not purified from the outside in, does God care about what people eat? One theologian, his name is Peter Lighthart, he makes a really compelling argument that says that all of the animals that God named as unclean were sort of symbolically related to the curse of the fall, symbolically related to the snake and the sin that came in Genesis 3. And so the dietary laws that God instituted were a way to remind the Israelites that they were not to commune with evil, that they were to remain pure from the impurity of evil. The people had been called by God to be holy, to be set apart, to be purified. So this wasn't a suggestion. It wasn't only just a symbolic thing, but actually God instituted this as a way that they could be reminded of and express their purity before God. So the Jewish people took these laws very seriously. But these purity laws were always meant to point people to the reality of just how impure they were. This pursuit of physical purity was always meant to be a visible sign of how they were meant to be spiritually pure. In this book, Keller summarizes one pastor's sermon on a passage from Zechariah. So yes, I'm a pastor quoting a pastor preaching on a prophet. So it's like the ultimate game of telephone. But in this sermon, the pastor talks about, his name is Ray Dillard, talks about all of the ceremonial purity that the Jewish people had to follow, and particularly the priests in the Old Testament. And so, for example, on the Day of Atonement, it was the one day a year that the priest could go into what was called the Holy of Holies in the temple. It was the place where God's presence was most fully made manifest. And to prepare himself to go into the Holy of Holies, he had to be isolated for a week to make sure he didn't actually eat or touch anything unclean. Then the night before he went into the Holy of Holies, he stayed up all night reading the Bible and praying. Then on the Day of Atonement, he would go into the Holy of Holies. He would make a sacrifice for his own sins before the altar of God. Then he would come out and he would bathe and he would get new fresh garments. Then he'd go back in. He'd make another sacrifice for the priests and all of their sins. And then he'd go out and he'd bathe and he'd change clothes and he'd go back in and he'd make a sacrifice on behalf of the people. And in Zechariah 3, Zechariah gets this vision of the priest in the Holy of Holies and he's filthy dirty. Now, this is something that would never have happened because they went through all of these ceremonially clean laws. But what God was doing was showing Zechariah just the reality of how impure we are. That even the priest, after all of this ritual cleaning, in God's eyes, was still filthy dirty. All of these Old Testament purity laws were just meant to show just how bad the problem really was. To show us that purity must come from the inside out. It cannot come from the outside in. So we do actually have a purity problem. But the problem is much worse than we think. It's not a problem that can be solved from the outside in. Now the Duggars are kind of an extreme example of this. But we do it too. What is it for you? What are the things in your life that you do that make you feel pure before God? For me, I graduated college and I had it in my mind that if I had an hour-long Bible study, doing the inductive Bible study every day, I was pretty good. That was my purity law. And then I got a job and suddenly I didn't have an hour to spend in the Word every day. And so I had to recognize that my purity didn't come from the things that I did. This isn't just a Christian problem either. I believe even if you're a non-Christian here this morning, all of us are living by some law or rule where we're trying to purify ourselves because we know that something is wrong with us. We're all trying to do it. We have a purity problem. So what's the solution? How do we get purified from the inside out? This is amazing. So we have to meet the purifier. You can go to the next slide. In verse 19, Mark tells us that in what Jesus was saying was he was declaring all foods clean. Now, this might seem like an insignificant detail, but again, remember, thousands of years the Jewish people had been building their culture around these purity laws. And with a word, it says that Jesus declared all foods clean. It's interesting, again, as Keller points out, Jesus doesn't just say all foods are clean, as if to kind of give his divine commentary on the Old Testament Jewish laws, or to say, oh yeah, no, those are outdated, we're going to just move on from those. No food was ever really unclean. But Jesus actually declares, he makes the food clean. We've seen the power of Jesus' word all throughout Mark. With his word, he calmed the storm. He raised a little girl from the dead. And this morning, with a word, he says, all foods are clean. You can no longer be stained by what you eat, because I am making all things pure. Now, how could Jesus make this claim? Well, Jesus was himself the only real pure person to ever live. Jesus did not have a purity problem. And so Jesus could declare by his word something is pure, and it is. So purity then, it's no longer accomplished from the outside in by things that we do, but purity is accomplished from the inside out by what Jesus says. Because see, if Jesus could declare food clean, he can also declare you and me clean just by his word. Now just think about for a moment the implications of this. If purity is in some way accomplished through Old Testament Jewish law, that is so limiting, right? And who has access to that purity? You have to know the Old Testament Jewish law. You have to be able to follow it. To uphold the Old Testament Jewish law, you have to know and have access to a priest and the temple. And so even in these times, the New Testament times, the access to this purity was so limited. But if Jesus is the purifying agent and not these dietary laws, this means that Jesus can bring purity to whomever he wants, whenever he wants, whatever he wants, and wherever he wants. And I think that's what we see in the next three stories, that Jesus is bringing his purity to all people, to all problems, in all places. We see it first in this incredible story with this woman in Tyre and Sidon. We have to spend a little time here to understand this, because I was super thrown off by this story when I first read it this week, and maybe you were too when you were listening to it. So Jesus makes this declaration, and then he's in Galilee at that time in Jewish territory. Then he goes immediately to Tyre and Sidon. Tyre and Sidon were kind of just symbolic cities of enemies of Jerusalem. These were powerful cities, but they were certainly Gentile cities. One commentator notes that in the Old Testament, they just became symbols for idolatry and paganism. And so it's important that this is, as soon as Jesus declares all things clean, he goes to this Gentile territory. And I believe he does this to demonstrate just how significant the declaration that he just made was. This wasn't a mistake. They didn't misunderstand him or misunderstand the implications of what he had said. So he goes to this pagan city. He wants to get some time to himself, and then this woman just barges in, right? Jesus cannot get any time to himself. Mark makes it very clear that this woman, she is a Gentile of Gentiles. If there is an unclean person, it's this woman, according to the Old Testament laws. She's impure, and she's making Jesus impure, if purity laws are still a thing. We don't really get the energy and the despair of the scene much here. Matthew kind of fills out some of the details here, but she seems to barge in and just start begging Jesus, "Please heal my daughter." And with the same veracity, Jesus' disciples are asking him, "Please get this woman out of here." They're so concerned. They don't understand what Jesus has just said about the purity laws, and they're so concerned that this woman's going to mess up what we're trying to do. We're trying to remain pure. We're trying to extend Jesus' or God's purity, and this woman's going to impact that. And in the midst of all of this, this commotion, this chaos, Jesus offers this woman what seems like, and frankly was, a very derogatory response. He calls this woman a dog. This sounds a lot more like Jack Sparrow than Jesus Christ, doesn't it? I definitely got Pirates of the Caribbean vibes here. So is he calling this woman a dog? Is he saying that she's not worthy of him? Well, in some sense, yes, but certainly from what we know about Jesus also, no. You see, a dog would have been a common way for a Jewish person to respond or to talk about a Gentile person. And so I think what Jesus is doing here is he's offering this woman the response that any good Jew who was concerned with purity would have offered this woman. He's speaking his disciples' language, and they're probably like, "Yeah, he's doing it. He's getting rid of her." But actually, what he's doing is he's giving this woman an incredible opportunity to show herself to be the first person in the book of Mark to actually understand who Jesus is. She's the first person in the book of Mark to actually understand a parable of Jesus Christ. She hears Jesus' response to her, and Mark says she answers him. Do you notice that he didn't actually ask her a question, but she answers him? I just want to take a moment. I mean, this is an incredible woman. One of the abuses of purity culture is this idea that we have to have very strict lines between how the sexes relate to one another. And there's something there. But I do believe that this woman exemplifies what it looks like to be a godly woman. This woman is listening so closely to Jesus Christ that she's not going to settle for less than who she knows him to be. And so she responds, even when Jesus doesn't ask a question. And I want to make the point that ladies, please be this committed to Jesus. Don't ever allow yourself to be silenced when you're speaking on his behalf. Jesus isn't afraid of strong women. But he embraces this woman here. We don't get it as much here in Mark, but again in Matthew, he compliments her and says, "Oh, woman, amazing answer," is what he says to her. "You have got it." She's the first person in the Gospel of Mark to understand who Jesus is. Because she's listening closely and she hears Jesus say, "Let the children be fed first." And she hears in that a promise that the food is not just for the children, but the food is also for the dogs. Even if the children are fed first, the dogs will be fed. And she knows that there's enough food on that table for her, and she asks for it now. And Jesus marvels at her. Now, every one of us might be saying, why did she not rebuke Jesus for calling her a dog? That was a very offensive thing for him to say. But this woman knew that what Jesus said about her was true. She did fit the meaning of this term. She was a dog, an unclean Gentile. But she also knew that Jesus was the perfect purifier. And so this fact was no problem for him. He could solve her problem. He was not limited to who he could purify. But whoever he declared pure was pure. And so she claimed that promise for herself. Now each one of us must realize this has to be our response to Jesus as well. We have to recognize that none of us on our own has a claim to sit at the table of God. Every one of us, in Jesus' words, are a dog. But Jesus came to allow dogs to sit at the table. And yes, if you're like me, you're picturing those paintings of all the dogs playing poker. Jesus came for the dogs. And that is good news for us because each one of us is impure. Like this woman who she did not have access to all of the things that were necessary for ritual purity. But she had access to Jesus, the perfect purifier, and she called on him to answer her plea. We must come to Jesus in the same way. Jesus' purity is for all people. The good news also is that Jesus' purity is for all problems. We see this in the next story where Jesus moves on from this area and he goes to the Decapolis. Now we've seen Jesus in the area of the Decapolis. That kind of, it meant 10 cities. So it was a big geographical area. And Jesus had been there before. He went there and he healed the man with thousands of demons. But then he left and he comes back now and it seems like people know who he is. That man has gone and told people about Jesus, which is what he was instructed to do. So Jesus shows up and people know about him and they beg Jesus to heal this man. And I want you just to look at just how personal Jesus is. We talked about the personal mercy of Christ a couple weeks ago. He takes this man aside, this man who probably had been gawked at his whole life. He took him aside and has this personal moment for him. And he does a lot of stuff that seems kind of weird on the outset. Like he touches the guy's ear and his tongue, and some commentators would say that they think that he's mimicking some magic, the kind of spells or incantations that were going on in the New Testament. I actually don't think that's what he's doing, but I think probably more likely what Tim Keller says is that he's using a language that this man would understand. Physical touch. He's using sign language to show this man how deeply he cares for him. I think what I really want you to notice, though, is how the people respond. Because again, now he's still in Gentile territory. And again, it seems like these Gentile people understand Jesus better than his own people understood him. He heals this man, and his own people were getting pretty mad when he was healing people, but not the Gentiles. The Gentiles say, he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. Now, if you know your Old Testament, this language should ring out and echoes because in Isaiah 35, the promise of the Messiah is the promise that the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped, the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. These Gentile people are, maybe they don't even know it, but they're echoing Old Testament Jewish prophecies. And when they say, he has made all things well, they're echoing Jesus, Genesis 1. Where God creates all things good. They recognize Jesus even when his own people don't recognize him. And so what they're pointing to, though, too, is what these prophecies pointed to. What even the creation account pointed to, that Jesus is making all things new. He's recreating all things that were impacted by the fall and broken by the fall. Jesus is making them all new. And so Jesus' purity, it's not just limited to any people, but it's for all people. It's not limited to just soul care. Jesus isn't just purifying souls, but as he purifies souls, that purity does go inward out so that there is a redemption of all things coming. So when I speak critically about purity culture, don't hear me saying that there is no purity that we're desiring, but it's the purity that comes from the inside out. As Jesus purifies our souls, he also renews our lives. Jesus is bringing the hope of true, perfect, comprehensive, all-encompassing purity that will bring justice and healing and renewal in all spheres. I believe that's what this last story is telling us about. That Jesus' purity comes to all people for all problems and in all places. Now, as Sherry was reading this, you might have said, wait a second, I feel like we've heard this before. This feeding of the 4,000. That's because Mark preached on the feeding of the 5,000 last week. And these stories are almost identical. They have a lot of things in common. Jesus has compassion on both the crowds. The disciples still don't know what the heck is going on. They eat bread and fish. The crowd sit down on the ground in a desolate place. They all eat and are satisfied. They take up extra food and they leave. Now, all these things have caused some commentators to say, this is just the same story. Somebody just accidentally copied the story twice. But that's not true because there are some significant differences between these two stories. And I think they're meant to tell us something about the point of why Jesus does this twice. First of all, they're in different locations. The first feeding took place in Jewish territory. Now this feeding is taking place in Gentile territory. And so the second difference is the people that are there. All of the people that are there are probably not Jewish people, but he's in Gentile land. And Jesus even says at one point they're all from far away. This is kind of an Old Testament moniker for the Gentile people, those who are from far off places. Now Jesus is feeding these people from far off places. And then lastly, one of the differences that you might notice is the difference in the numbers, right? So the number of baskets taking up after the feeding. In the first feeding, it was 12. And the second feeding, it was 7. What's the significance of that? Well, when Jesus was in Jewish territory, he took up 12 extra baskets. Now, 12 was an important number for the Jewish people as it represented the 12 tribes of Israel. So what I think Jesus was doing with the first feeding was showing he came for Israel. He came to purify Israel. Today, we have 7 baskets taken up, and 7 is also a significant number in the Bible because it's a number for fullness, completion. It's the day that God rested from creation. Totality, finality, completion is represented by this number. And so what I believe Jesus is teaching us this morning is he came not just to purify Israel, but to purify the entire world, to bring the hope of restoration to everyone, everywhere. Jesus is pointing to that day when the prophets talked about where God's glory will cover the face of the earth as the waters cover the sea. Jesus is bringing purity for all places, total and complete purity. And that purity must start with us. And it must start on the inside and work its way out. So you might wonder, okay, so how do I get purified from the inside out? All we ever know, all we naturally think is I'm going to purify myself from the outside in. It's our instinct. So how do we get purified from the inside out? We must have Jesus. We must take Jesus into us. And I know this sounds weird, but after the feeding of the 5,000 in the book of John, Jesus explains its meaning. And he says, I am the bread of the world. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood will have eternal life. So yes, it sounds weird, but Jesus said it, not me, so you can talk to him. And his people thought it sounded weird too. How do we feast on Jesus? What does it look like to eat his body and drink his blood? Well, in a few minutes, we'll do that at the communion table. But we don't believe that just by taking the cracker and drinking the juice, you're suddenly purified. The purifying agent is the faith that you come with. And so how do we take Jesus into us? We do it by faith. We place our faith in him as this purifier that we all so desperately need. And then we come by faith, drinking the wine, eating the bread, trusting that Jesus is present to us in it. If not physically, spiritually. And as such, he can purify us from the inside out. It's our only hope. We have a purity problem. The problem doesn't go away if we just ignore it. And we can't solve the problem on our own. The problem is only solved as we come to Christ by faith. And he comes and dwells in us. And he purifies us from the inside out. Let's pray. God, we don't like to admit that we have a purity problem. Even as I say it with my mouth, I just wonder how much I truly believe it in my heart. Self-righteousness is so much a part of who we are. And so, God, I pray that you give us the humility to admit and to truly believe that we have a purity problem. And then once we recognize that, God, I pray that you give us the eyes to see just how deep it is. That we would stop trying to solve our purity problem from the outside in. But that we would look to you by faith to purify us from the inside out. And in so doing, God, would you then make us agents of purity for the world? Of a purity that's not gross or unattractive, but actually is the purity that we're all longing for. This is a work that truly only you can do. And so I ask that you would, in Jesus' name, amen. I want to invite you to consider as the music team plays, just in what ways are you seeking to solve your own purity problem, or maybe ignoring the purity problem, and what would it look like for you to come by faith to Jesus Christ and be purified from the inside out this morning? Let's do that as the music team plays a song of response.